Hi, Internet. My name is John Matos.
And this is Melissa Matos.
Welcome to Unboxing Story, where we unpack fiction without the friction. I almost lost it there in the middle. All right, ready to ship.
You got it.
And this is interesting because this became a discussion before. Because we've been talking kind of about hope punk as like this way of having stories that have stakes without them being completely depressing. So up until now, it's just been kind of a conversation about like fantasy that's for adults or sci-fi that's for adults. So we're going to talk about The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. But me and Melissa are like lifelong fans of The Muppet, what she wanted to call Into the Muppetverse.
Muppetverse! You know there's a Muppetverse.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because that's what's funny about Henson versus somebody like Disney was that, like, and I have different creators like this that I kind of hold in my, like Mount Rushmore of people. And it's funny because each one of them seems to have a different, like, position about running their creativity as, like, a business. So, like, say, like, Stan Lee, he was all for, like, yes, we are this company, and we're going to take over comics. And if DC, the distinguished competition is doing this thing, we're going to do it and do it better. And it was always in good fun, but he was not shy about just promoting the heck out of Marvel. Versus somebody like Charles Schulz, who had very specific ethical and like.
Specific artistic vision.
Yeah.
Not that Marvel doesn't have a specific vision, but it wasn't as global. Like, it was a lot more precise.
So it was interesting because he was more of a reserved person, and he wasn't like Stan Lee was going all around, like, colleges talking about comics and how it's an art form and stuff like that. Because, like, Peanuts started out as a comic strip, it was not yet the global phenomenon that, like, you could buy Snoopy lunchboxes and stuff like that. Anyway, all that to say that, like, Henson is such an interesting thing because he created a felt green thing with ping pong balls
for eyes. And we all think he's alive and love him.
And, like, somehow it managed to stay culturally relevant way past what you would assume Muppets would do.
Yep.
Like, some, and even, like, I still have on my Spotify, like, an album of alt rock people doing covers of
Muppet
stuff. So, like, it's the Fray did the Muppet theme.
Oh, really?
And so it's this really cool, like, you know, hippie-sounding thing. And then Haley Williams from Paramore and the Reverse Cuomo from Weezer did the Rainbow Connection as a duet. And it's, like, it still seems like, and it's one of my favorite things about the Muppets growing up was that, like, they treated them as if they were stars, as if they were celebrities. And so it forces all these, like, random people in Hollywood and singers and all these different talented people to talk to Muppets as if they're real people.
My favorite is always watching, like, if they ever happen to be on a talk show with other guests.
Right.
And the other guests will talk to the puppets. They don't talk to, and you can see the guy running the puppet. Like, he's not hiding behind the couch or anything. He's sitting right there. But they will talk to Kermit instead of Henson because Kermit is so real. Right. Like, it just blows my mind. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but as far as the Muppetverse goes, like, we were playing around with that being headcanon, that there are actual alternate versions, alternate realities with the different Muppet properties. Right. But really, you're right. They have a meta headcanon already there, right? That they are actors,
right?
That they have their own studio,
and that
they are starring in these movies,
yeah,
like the way they did the Muppet Show.
That was the cool thing growing up, was that they were still doing, once Disney bought them, they were doing, like, they did Treasure Island and they did the Christmas Carol,
which I love. That's so, still my favorite version of the Christmas Carol.
It's so many people's version, favorite versions of that, but, like, it's so funny because they still, what I like about them is that they still maintained Henson's vision of them being these weird, like, creatures that have somehow been allowed to star in their own movies.
Hollywood, because they had that one movie where they broke into Hollywood, and now they're here. Yeah. So you're stuck with frogs and bears and whatever.
Right. So it's this interesting thing because it's like they represent kind of like your imagination. Like there's all these different characters and they all have their own personalities and they're allowed to be kind of like these crazy little gremlins that are allowed to be in this Hollywood machine. And you have people like, you know, it like in the new Muppet movie. That's why I thought it was so nice that I forget his name, but the actor that stars in that, he specifically decided like, we need to do another one. It's time for another one, but I want to do it right.
Right.
And he did another one like the old 70s movies.
Yeah.
And you have people like Whoopi Goldberg and, you know, just...
Because everybody wants to work with the Muppets.
Yeah.
Like, everybody. I mean, can you imagine, like, if you're Michael Caine and somebody calls you up and you're like, oh, you're going to be Scrooge in the Muppet, and, you know, in the Christmas Carol. And it's like, oh, great, who's playing Bob Cratchit? Kermit the Frog. Sign me up right now. Doing this movie.
But another thing that I think is cool is that Henson he established that, and that worked very well. But then he also did other productions, and he made Muppet, like, puppetry.
Like my favorite
Star Wars
still,
and...
Well, I still think that was the best way to do Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
I still love that better than CGI.
Right.
Because you, as an actor, to have to stare into empty space and do your part, as opposed to having a thing right there that you are talking to,
right.
Considering that normal human beings, when they're not acting, will talk to these puppets, like,
mm-hmm.
I can't imagine it being a better situation. I miss and loved the Jim Henson Hour so much. Like, they had branched out for a while into multiple different shows, and I loved all of them. But the Jim Henson Hour was my favorite because they literally could just do whatever they wanted for that episode. Like, they were just random different stories each episode, and it was beautiful. And they had this white lion that he would do the intro with.
Oh, right, right,
this huge white lion puppet and just hanging out. Like, anyway, it was great.
But specifically, we want to talk about the Dark Crystal and what it represents within fantasy. Because Melissa brought up the point that there's this way in which Dark Crystal, the original film, presents itself, that the minute that you're in it, you know that this is a completely different atmosphere that you're in. And so we can start to talk about that like there's other films and stories that have like otherworldly elements to them. But there aren't many that say, like, okay, this world works completely differently than the world that you know.
Right. And it's hard. I mean, I imagine it's easier in movie than in a novel.
Mm.
Although in a novel, you have a little more time to kind of build up what's going on.
Mm.
But in a movie, you have to establish in your first scene everything, you know, the tone of your thing. So, like, Star Wars does it very well also, where you're just, like, over a planet and there are massive spaceships shooting at each other. Like, you immediately get the feeling of this whole thing. But Dark Crystal starts with that weird, twisted castle in the middle of a barren landscape with, like, weird purple lightning, and then those Skeksis thing shows up, and you're like, okay, oh my goodness, where are we? Like, this is so alien to any other setting you know.
Right.
Thankfully, they have a narrator, which they continued into the show as well.
Yeah.
Otherwise.
But yeah, like, and I love the idea, personally, like, I love the idea that these Skeksis things, and it's something I brought up with the show, that in so many other things, there's some kind of inciting incident, and it's drawing somebody into, like, a quest. And so, in order to set up exposition, it's usually very slow in order to be like, okay, this is how our world works. And then starting with act two, you start to get a lot of like the conflict. But what I like about both the movie and the show is that it's starting out with like, okay, there are these weird vulture things that are ruling over all of these cute creatures.
Of course, sweet, adorable creatures.
And so you immediately know something is wrong. And I like because it's one of those things that, like, I don't know, it makes me think about other fantasy things and wonder why they think it takes a lot for a kid to understand when something is wrong.
Right.
And why they have to, like, for example, have the villain either kill someone or, like, torture someone to convince you this is a bad person.
The
minute that you see these things and how huge they are in comparison to the Gelfling, which are the heroes, like, you're just like, okay, these are the bad guys. But it sets up that they're in power and that they have this crystal and that they're using it to draw the life force out of
these, out of the planet.
And so, like, I would kind of compare it in my mind to something like The Neverending Story, because there are so many elements in that that are trying to create a fantasy world within a film.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that was based on a book or not.
I don't know.
But all to say that the movie does enough to set up its world, and that you get, you know, there's the darkness that's there. And so the whole mystery is trying to figure out what that is and how they can stop it. I kind of wanted to bring up that there's been a lot of, like resistance stuff coded into fantasy. And I think the one example that people are kind of like, roll their eyes at is with the Star Wars The Last Jedi.
It is a novel.
Oh, okay.
Well, there
you
go. A novel. By Michael Endy.
Because it's interesting between Rogue One and The Last Jedi, they were trying to kind of introduce this idea of the resistance.
Right.
And I think there are a couple things, like when Rose like rams Finn's plane out of the way and says, "It's love that will save us all." Like, there are those types of things that people are just like, okay, like, what are we doing here? But I really like how in Dark Crystal, like, for example, in the show, there's a character who is talking to the tree. And you get this right away that she is somebody who cares about, like, nature and is down there, like,
feeding the little bug things.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, one of them starts trying to kill her.
Yeah. It just tries to bite her in half.
And it's like, and I just feel so attached, like, instantly.
Yeah.
I'm attached to her. I like her. And I actually feel like she might get eaten in a way that with another show, I would just be like, okay, somebody's going to save her.
Right.
Like,
so the whole time I was watching, especially her storyline, I could not help but make comparisons back to another recent episode of ours where we were talking about the Shannara Chronicles.
Mm.
And in the Shannara Chronicles, there are very few of the characters that you care anything about right away because they're all being dumb.
Mm.
And, like, they don't give us any reason to like them too much.
Mm.
And then the tree starts trying to tell them, hey, there's a problem. Mm. And nobody cares because nobody was told, hey, maybe this tree might be important. In this version, in the Dark Crystal show, and like her introduction part isn't even that long. Like, they set up the other two characters a lot more.
Right.
I think her part is really simple. She's gathering moss and singing a song about caring for other things. She takes the moss and starts feeding the buggy things that live down there. She finds a little baby one and she's playing with the little baby one, and then you show the evilness coming into the moss, it gets fed to the little one, and then they all go crazy.
Yeah.
Like, in 10 minutes, I love this puppet and want her to be safe and know that she is the chosen one of this tree. Like, in 10 minutes. Take some lessons, people.
You didn't care. Yeah. Because I think that with the Shannara Chronicles, they did stuff to try to set up, like, political intrigue.
Yeah.
But it was all very dry.
Yeah.
There was this idea of the king has been kind of talking about this tree, and they're trying to set up that his son doesn't trust in his leadership, but it doesn't feel like this stuff is immediate.
Like, the only guy in the Shannara Chronicles that you feel any kind of, oh, he's awesome and I'm going to watch his story, is the druid guy.
Mm.
Like, because he wakes up and you're instantaneously, okay, that guy knows how to get stuff done.
Right.
And this guy's going to, you know.
But then
nobody else in the show is like.
It was a weird thing because it seemed like they were trying to have their cake and eat it too, to have this super melodramatic fantasy show. but also have it be this teen romantic drama thing.
Yeah.
And neither did I really feel, unless it was like you were saying with the druid, where it felt like he was in a show.
Yeah.
The other people were just kind of like they were playing pretend.
Right.
But I think that that's what's so cool about how the Henson Company, even well past Henson passing away, has maintained the spirit of creativity
yeah.
with his ideas and with the costume design and all that stuff of these creatures, where they feel like they're real.
Yeah.
They feel like they're, even with the limited emotion that they're able to portray,
but that's
you
the
get
thing,
that across.
The form of puppetry that the Muppets have always had, like, if you look at any of the other Muppets, like Kermit or Miss Piggy, any of them, their faces don't move much.
Right.
It's not like sometimes they'll have eyebrows that move up and down, but it is the person working that puppet that gives it its emotion.
Right.
Like, Kermit's face scrunches in different ways.
Right,
so,
right,
like,
right.
they can do that. But, like, otherwise it is just literally the full body motion and voice reaction
right.
that puppet gives off. I mean, I remember watching, like, a real short, I don't even remember if it was Sesame Street or what it was on, where it's two, like, slinkies with eyeballs dancing to a song. And, like, every now and then there's this big one that's dancing, and this little tiny one comes out and starts trying to dance with them, and the big one starts stepping on them. It's, like, 5 minutes, not even 5 minutes. Like, it's a song worth of two slinkies dancing, and they have personalities and lives that you, like, have backstory to two slinkies. I'm like, how do you, like, the level of commitment to those characters, I think, is what really, the level of commitment to the characters and the willing to push boundaries on your setting, I think, is what really drives and makes those amazing. Because, like, Shannara didn't do enough. They weren't willing to push it far enough to say we are wholeheartedly immersing ourselves in this crazy fantasy world and, like, going for it. Like, it didn't feel like they're just like, oh, we're just going to, like, do a half-done CW show like we do with all the other ones.
Right.
And not actually commit to that. But, like, the minute you're in Dark Crystal, you are committed to that world. And you can feel everything in it is committed to that world.
Right. And I think that that's what's funny is that, like, it, I was saying that one thing I dislike about some, not all, but some cartoons today is that there's been this switch from having dramas that are funny. Like, for example, like the Ninja Turtles movies, it is a ridiculous premise
yes.
to have teenage mutants that are ninjas and turtles.
And turtles.
However, those movies take it seriously
yes.
that this rat learned ninjutsu from his master.
Taught turtles.
Taught that ninjutsu to his turtle sons. And it makes it hilarious
yes.
when there are jokes in it because it plays off of the ridiculousness of the whole thing. It creates a semblance of reality.
Right.
And then it's just like, and they're also turtles.
Right. So, for example, the running joke for one of the running jokes for Dark Crystal is the fact that female Gelflings have wings and the males don't.
Right.
So they have a lot of fun scenes. Like in the first one, you don't know that. So the
yeah.
first time you see it, she's like, he's like, wait, you have wings. Like, of course I do. I'm a girl.
Yeah.
Like, duh. Like, it's just that cuteness of, sorry, tough luck, dude, you can't fly.
Right.
That's just really, I don't know. It's adorable.
Right, but it comes across because that's a joke between them.
Because it's a joke for their race. Like, it's built into their world that
right.
this is a joke.
And then on the kind of morbid side, the one villain in the new show is constantly sick.
Yes.
And the way that they show this
no,
is
so
that
gross.
Her nose is always running. And they created this kind of gelatin stuff.
Yes.
That looks like snot.
Oh, it's nasty.
And it's just constant. Like,
yeah.
she's constantly wiping
her face. She's always
wiping
her
face.
Face and, like, her
but
pustules
it
are, like,
it makes it
leaking.
So that you can't look at this character. And it gets across this idea of them being these gross creatures.
Because they're dying. They're decaying. They,
right.
They're on the way out, and they keep fighting it.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, you just don't let it go.
Uh-huh. But then, on the other hand, what I think is cool is that if you look at these creatures, like, they all have this sense of being kind of animalistic. It's what's interesting about them is that the Gelfling are like kind of like elvish type things.
Right.
But then they also have pointed
yeah, they're very
snout-like
almost
faces.
Like deer-like looking. They have very big
right.
eyes and long
so there's
faces.
A lot of these things And then one of the major things that wasn't, as far as I remember, wasn't in the first movie. You were making the idea that maybe the beetles that you see in the movie are now just mealybugs. Because they have these mealybug things,
oh, yeah.
And they, like, come out of their little, like, tunnels to go, and I'm not sure, like, they're not.
They don't really explain what they're doing. Just
yeah.
Like, what's with the buggies? They're cute, but what's with the buggies?
But then they have these huge chariot things, and all of a sudden, the mealybugs roll up, and they get
and they
into the axle of the
thing, and become the tires.
And they're the tires for the...
I was like, oh.
But it's just, like, those types of really creative elements make it feel like a different type of world.
Yeah.
And there's this feeling of, and I think that's the distinction that I want to make between whimsy and wonder, is that I feel like there's been this trend towards making something, whether it's like anesthetizing it from like horror elements, or making it so that there needs to be a joke every like 30 seconds or so, that you're getting into this territory of, we need to have all kids shows be like Sesame Street.
Right.
And what I like about something like Dark Crystal is it's not trying to be, I think we'll get into more of that in the second half, but it's not trying to be scary. It's not trying to be
edgy. Right. It's not trying to be dark, grim, or anything. It's
There's
just
this
different.
Idea that
it's supposed to be very
bad
alien
guys,
and wonderful.
Yeah, the bad guys are really bad guys. The heroes are really heroic. And
although this one they did get, well, we can get into more details when we talk about it. But this one I think had more middle areas than previously, or at least we're pointing out that not all of the bad things are the things that look like bad things.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. So since we're trying to keep these to 40 minutes.
Yes.
I will pause here
for our beautiful listeners,
and we'll use that as our preview for after the
mid-roll
break.
That works too.
Okay. All right, we're back. Oh, Jiminy Cricket, I ate too many pizza.
Yeah.
Too many pizza.
Too many pizza.
So before the podcast, I was talking about Timothy Burton.
Yes.
And his influence on the genre, because we have kind of like the Nightmare Before Christmas and Edward Scissorhands and things that they're not really made for adult, and they're not really what you would call kid friendly, but they seem like they're trying to push creepiness as like a brand.
Yeah.
So like I would say like Alice in Wonderland, that his version of it, is a good example where it's not much more like comparing that to like Bambi.
Yeah.
Not like there's more or less death and hard things to get over, but it's actually focusing on the morbid aspects and making that part of the attraction of it, is that this is going to be its own brand of kind of like, you know, gothy kid horror or something. So what I'm saying I don't like about that is that it makes it seem like you shouldn't, like, it seems to create this divide in my mind between, okay, there's this stuff that's trying to be edgy and cool, and then there's, like, kiddie stuff. And, like, growing up with stuff like, you know, We're Back, A Dinosaur Story, stuff like that.
Oh, man.
Like...
That's a whole episode on itself, yeah. Right there, John. We need to write that down, because weird childhood movies. That's what that needs to go under.
But yeah, I think that
one and All Dogs Go to Heaven.
Yeah, but it's interesting to me because it seems like codifying these fantasy tropes as a product is part of the problem, because you have to make it seem like this is the type of product you are getting for your child. It's like growing up, you know, in the 1500s in England, it's not like you're trying to say, we're going to tell this type of story. It just was a thing. You had stories told to you, and it depended on what your parent wanted to do. If they wanted to scare you into sleeping early, they would do that. Or if they wanted to, like, you know, talk about Santa Claus and reward good behavior, then they would do that. But I just feel like I put it out on the table. What do you think is the line? And what do you think about people trying to dance around it?
The line between...
Well, and therein lies the question, isn't
it?
Because, like, personally, like, what I think Mirror Bat gets wrong is that 75% of it is a fairly pleasant
right.
children's movie. And then the last 25%, two kids get, like, there's the prospect that they could turn into mutants, maybe. And then their friends become meat-eating
yeah,
monsters.
Horrifying. Yeah.
So. Oh, and then a guy gets pecked to death. But,
yes,
yeah,
by crows.
Because,
you know. So, it's hard to say because, like I was saying, sometimes, like, Tim Burton, I think, does, not always, but, like, because Edward Scissorhands was more than just setting. That was a weird story all overall. But the, and I mean weird in the genre sense of weird.
Uh-huh. That's what I'm saying. It's like his brand. It's not
yeah.
like, it's this is a fairy tale.
Right.
But it is,
but
it
I'm
is my specific
strange.
Vision of
yeah.
what it
and
is.
And depending on the thing, I think it works. Like, so for example, when they did the movie versions of Lemony Snicket, the series of unfortunate events, mm-hmm. they felt very Tim Burton-y. But that worked for that kind of story because it was a very macabre kind of story.
Right.
I'm not terribly happy about them putting it on, like, everything.
Mm.
Like, it shouldn't just randomly show up because that's the aesthetic you want. Like, you need to have a reason for it to be there. But usually it's in a mildly macabre kind of story. And I don't mind. I like macabre stuff. I like dark comedies. I like, you know, goth-flavored kinds of stuff. And so having that as a brand, I don't think is a horrible thing, but I prefer stuff like Dark Crystal where it's more integral to what you're doing, which is why I think I like fantasy more than just, you know, random Tim Burton movie of the year thing.
Yeah.
Like I want it to be part of the world. I want there to be reasons why these things are there.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause like in, it's kind of the steampunk dilemma. Because steampunk is, like, basically goth's, like, brother.
Uh-huh.
Twin brother that wears brown instead of black. That's, like, how that works.
That is creepy.
That's what I've heard. Steampunk is what happened when goths discovered brown. That's, like... Anyway. It's... Because steampunk basically says we want this aesthetic, right? We want gears and we want Victorian-esque stuff.
Uh-huh.
And we want it to be mildly macabre all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they never really... Most of the things I've read never tell you why they're like that.
Mm.
Like, the first time I actually enjoyed the adventure story set in steampunk world was Jim Butcher's, because he actually goes into the world building of this is what's happening, and this is why everybody's stuck in the Victorian era, and why everybody's doing things this way. Like, there was a whole world building thing,
right.
as opposed to just, we're going to throw this aesthetic on top of this to give you this weird feeling for no reason.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that, like, say, so I think Lemony Snicket's a good example, because it felt like, one of the things that it felt like was, it had the irony of, here's this creepy uncle character who's trying to kidnap the Baudelaire children. And so it's funny because there are a lot of people that don't get that he's evil. But then there were weird things, like, that were, to me, part of the bad irony of, like, say, a bad goth clique, where it was like there were certain characters, like, for example, there was one caretaker or something, and they were trying to decide whether they were evil, and they didn't read. And so there was this kind of, like, elitist thing where one of the kids was just like, well, maybe if they read, we would know whether they were a good person or not. And so it's part of that, they're trying to make the irony of this kind of different aesthetic to be like, this is a world in which more often than not people are evil.
Right.
And it's them trying to learn the difference between good and bad.
And are you going off of the movie one or the show?
I think that was in the book.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, probably. But the book also is very much more into, you know, you should be well informed about the world.
Right,
and the less informed you are about
that's
the world,
what I wanna, that's what
the
I
more likely
say
you
that,
are to be evil.
It was interesting because growing up, like, mom and dad weren't necessarily that picky in terms of, like, you shouldn't read Harry Potter or something like that. They were very much, I wouldn't say against, but they weren't, like, for restricting,
right.
like, things based on.
But they made sure that they talked to us about everything.
Uh-huh.
Like, there was nothing that we would have, they would have felt uncomfortable. Like, okay, look, here we heard that you read this, or we heard that you were going to sit and watch this with you, and we're going to talk about what that means.
Uh-huh.
Instead of just, you know, leaving us to flounder in the sea of...
Well, I thought that, I always thought that was my idea.
No,
I didn't necessarily...
That was mom and dad being a good mom
maybe.
And dad.
Maybe. Who knows? But I think by the time they got to me, they were just tired and I was talking.
Well, you grew up in that atmosphere, so it was just natural for
us
to do it.
Right, but yeah, so it wasn't necessarily that they sat me down and explained to
me
anything.
Well, no, but like...
But I always knew that I could talk to them about what I was watching. So, like, it's just interesting because that... I remember... Mom telling me, like, I don't like how in Harry Potter there's this weird feeling of I don't know who is good and who is bad, as opposed to in Lord of the Rings,
you know,
it's very obvious who is good and who is bad. And so what that was an interesting thing to me was that, like, it wasn't necessarily that our parents were on the, they were, but what you call it, deluded to the fact that J.K. Rowling as an author didn't know the good difference between good and evil.
No.
It seems like a lot of critics of, or censors of, children's literature try to make the case that a kid doesn't understand right from wrong.
Yeah, and that's nonsense.
And they're
going to
be
tricked
by a book. But at the same time, there are books that are more prescriptive about this is a good person, this is a bad person. And I think that with authors like J.K. Rowling or people like Tim Burton, they're trying to instill that question a little bit earlier than some people are comfortable with.
Right.
Of, like, you don't know who you can trust. Like, for example, in Edward Scissorhands, it's kind of interesting because you can kind of make the case that that's like a Beauty and the Beast type thing. But it's actually more about, like, he's actually interfacing with the townspeople. And they're like, oh, this guy is normal. Just because he looks different doesn't mean he is bad. And so you start to get, like, the idea of, like, what's socially acceptable and what's, like, that there are people that are ostracized and then they have to make an extra effort to integrate into society. And so you start getting those things about, like that whole thing is about he's in this suburb.
Right.
And all of a sudden you make a left and there's this, like, scary castle thing.
Yeah.
So you start getting into that,
yeah,
like the social mores.
But so what I appreciated about the new Dark Crystal show, as in the movie, everything's very good and evil. Like, you know immediately who's bad. You know, although Agra might be a question still, because you're never really quite sure what in the world is up with Agra. But it's very clear. Okay, the Gelfling has been given this job by the Mystics, which we haven't seen the Mystics in the show yet, so where they are. But the Mystics give this one Gelfling, is like, look, you have to go fix this crystal. Go get the piece from Agra, go stick it in the crystal, you need to fix this thing. Okay. So he has a quest. He runs into a girl Gelfling, and they do their quest, right? Like, it's very simple hero story, whatever. The nice thing about the show is we're now getting gray areas, right? Like, there's some of the storylines where it's very clear, like, okay, that chick was picked by the tree, and the tree is going to tell her, like, you need to go fix this, because there's a problem. But then the two soldier kids who are working for the Skeksis, like, directly, they're in the castle,
right,
have their own issues that they have to come up with, because his father is their chief guard. Like, he has to deal with that now.
Right.
But then the most interesting one is the princess of the Gelflings, realizes that her entire life is built on stuff that the Skeksis have taken from other people. Like, they have that scene where the thing that they pried out of that poor farmer chick's hands, because they had nothing else to tithe to these horrible Skeksis.
We'll take
the pretty necklace. Her mother, the queen, Gelfling, gets that necklace as a reward. And the princess is like, wait a minute, what? We just, like, stole this from somebody, and now you're keeping it? Like, what is happening?
Right.
And so she's understanding now all of a sudden the like her whole life has been a messed up thing.
Right.
So I'm really eager to see how they go with her storyline, because she's now like, well, forget this. I'm going to change lives because I'm in a position that I can.
Right.
And see how far I can go before they find out that I'm the one messing this up. Like, I don't know. I just think they said that whole first episode was a really good setup for a very interesting show. And yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing the rest.
And I just think that, like, growing up in a conservative atmosphere, it just, I feel like there are certain messages about there being like this danger, like in the 80s, they called it the Satanic Panic. And there was this whole movement of, you know, these symbols, because they are satanic, are being used to indoctrinate your child. And I think that's kind of come down in certain areas. There are people that I think are a lot more wise in that, in those respects, to realize that it is like Disney is not trying to get your kid to buy a wand and perform magic. But I just think that that's on the other side of the foot. It's not as if like your kid is going to die if they can't watch. You know, like I remember the one show that I couldn't watch as a kid was The Smurfs.
Yes,
and it's like, I couldn't care less about the Smurfs,
like,
Mom and Dad.
Oh, well.
I hate to break it to you. But like that, like, and there is, it is very easy, I think, to talk to those people out there, that it's very easy to have some awareness of what a program is like, and to know that it's like, there's not, when you have like good and evil, if you have a witch and a wizard, that they're not, like, if you take 5 minutes to watch the thing, you can kind of tell
the
difference between
it. Like, because there's a difference between, like, Dark Crystal or Lord of the Rings, where they have witches and wizards, and it's part of the world that they're in,
uh-huh.
as opposed to setting, like, a lot of urban fantasy, where certain, not all of them, but a lot of, some of them are portraying witches the way witches would be here.
Uh-huh.
So, like, actually making pacts with supernatural creatures that are giving them their powers. And treating it as this glamorous thing,
uh-huh.
as opposed to showing, you know, this is probably a bad idea.
Like, and I think that I think I definitely want to have an episode about, because the last novel that I finished writing was about the 50s and how there was a movement based on the work by a German psychologist, Frederick Wortham, who wrote a book called The Seduction of the Innocent. And it was about kids reading comics and how it was making them all juvenile delinquents and like deviants and stuff. But like, if you actually look at some things, like, say, for example, in the fantasy genre, the Golden Compass is propaganda against the church.
And the author came out and just straight up admitted that. Like, that wasn't people putting that on
but
him.
But he does dance around it, because he tries to make it seem like it's objective in some way. And it's not. It is anti the church.
Yeah.
In the guy that wrote Wonder Woman when it was first coming out was trying to put disc theory into the comic. He was trying to make it appealing to people, and this kind of, it was kind of a theory that he had, that you want someone who is controlling to give you some kind of authority and stuff like that. So like, It's a strange thing, because you can't really go into writing something without putting some of your beliefs into it. So if you are an anti-theist, or if you are, Marxist or something like that, like, there's a way in which that bleeds into the thing that you're making. And so I think you can kind of like go here or there about whether these people actually want to convince a child about what they think. I just feel like it's an interesting thing to talk about, because
right.
it's not, I feel like it's better to talk about it rather than make it like something that you can't touch and that nobody
right.
can
well, look, so the
debate
point,
about.
The To me, the point of reading stories by other people is to see someone else's viewpoint, to experience something from someone else's viewpoint, because it's the closest thing you can get to being inside somebody else's head, right, is by experiencing their story that they're telling you. Whether or not the purpose, the point of, is that the author is trying to propagandize something is almost irrelevant.
You can read it
and you can experience it, but you don't have to let that take over your brain, right? Mm-hmm. You're reading it and experiencing it to understand someone else, mm-hmm. so that when you talk to that person, you know where they're coming from, right? Mm-hmm. You have something in common that you can talk about. Mm-hmm. That does not automatically mean that, you know, you're going to believe exactly what they believe because you read this book. Like, if you have your brain engaged when you're reading or experiencing things, you're like, okay, I know what I believe is true. This is what this person believes is true. Do I agree with any of that? Do I disagree with any of that? What's the best way to talk to them going forward? Because I still need to treat them like a human being, right? And just because they believe differently than me doesn't mean they're not a human being. So how does this, you know, and that is supposed to help you going forward in understanding other human beings.
Yes. And I think that the kind of like what I would hope that kids, like if your kid wants to, and like I said, it is kind of weird because of how, you know, a lot of videos on the internet are free and a lot of games are starting to be free now. There's kind of this growing entitlement with the youth of America that, like, because they see a thing, they need to have a thing. So it's a weird thing to negotiate that way because it's like, well, no, this is a privilege that you have to do, watch this or that. But at the same time, like, being able to sit with a young boy and say, like, just because this game has swords in it doesn't mean that it's necessarily bad. You can kind of, like, I think the kid will get more out of playing that with you or watching something with you so that you can teach them, okay, this is... What you're watching now is war.
Yeah.
War is not, most of the time,
war is terrible.
You want to try to avoid
yeah.
what's happening here. And like that can be a learning experience as opposed to if your first reaction with a child is to try to, you know, keep them from that thing. And usually, like, you know, you can discern at which point, you know, like, everybody has to have the talk after Charlotte's Web.
Yes.
That
stuff
this,
dies.
This stuff happens, and it's not cool.
Yes.
But it does happen.
At the same time, though, it's weird, because, like, I almost feel like people are going to an extreme with things now, especially with games.
Uh-huh.
Like, people are creating games designed to help you experience stuff that no one should have to experience, unless you have to. Like, there are some things that, like, yes, you need to know they exist, but... Uh-huh. If you are lucky enough to not have to go through those things, then by all means, don't go through those things.
You don't think you need to fight a zombie horde?
No, not that. Like, there was that one about, like, somebody, you're playing a character whose mother or something is dying of cancer.
Uh-huh.
Or there's games about, like, growing up as an abused child. Stuff like that, where it's just like, you were lucky enough not to have that. Yes, there are people that have this, and it's horrifying, and I'm sorry, and, like, you need to know it exists, and yes, maybe you should see their stories, but role-playing out these things is not necessarily a blessing, because there are some things that I will not read or watch, like I've talked about rape triggers before, and there are certain amounts, I have a very low threshold for rape stories. I'm like, yes, I know it exists, trust me, I can imagine just exactly how horrifying that is. I don't need help with that. Like, I don't need to have that in my head.
Right.
So there's, like, some stuff where I'm just like, yes, there is horrors out there.
Yeah, like, I know my girlfriend and I have a running joke. As somebody that likes independent film, we go see some things that are weird. But she went to see The Florida Project.
Oh.
And one of the things about it is that it's not a traditional script, I don't think. And it's not, it's just basically, let's watch this incredibly poor woman be poor with her child and the character is just a very bad mother. And so I think it's about, there's a guy, I don't know if he's like a salesman or something, but he sees that this girl's in the situation. And I think it's just very agonizing to watch because it's nothing but watching this woman be a bad mother for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So, like, there's those types of things where I think it starts to become a bigger question about how much does seeing somebody else's perspective actually help? How much empathy can you how much can you grow by just, like, in taking other suffering? Because there are limits to that which you can actually... And I think that's one of the things that...
And it still isn't the actual suffering. Like, it's one thing to read someone else's experiences and say, okay, now I have a way to try and understand them better.
Mm-hmm.
But people come out of it, like, thinking that they've gone through the same thing, and it's not. Like, you don't know what that's like to go through till you really go through it, if you have to. And if you don't have to, then don't put yourself, like, why are you, I don't understand why you would do this to yourself. Anyway.
Well, I think we've gotten to a too big a question.
Too big a content.
For this episode.
For the rest of this episode.
But we'd like to hear your thoughts. If you want to hit us up at Unboxing Story or on our Facebook at Unboxing Story. You can also email us at unboxingstorypodcast@gmail.com or... at our Anchor page, you can leave us a message. And we would love to have you on the podcast. And we'll play your lovely voice.
Yes.
And then talk back to it. As if you are here in the room with us. A mystical experience. All right, that's enough for me.
Yeah, we're done.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
Bye.